welcome to Escape from Lockdown, a show all about how we got into this madness and how we're going to get out of it. Now, this week's guest is somebody very special. He first came to my attention through an incredible Twitter thread that he put out online and really gained an enormous amount of traction right across the world, because it showed something fairly nefarious about how our social media is being manipulated by the People's Republic of China in order to bring in what I consider the disastrous lockdown policy. He is, of course, the lawyer and researcher, Michael P. Senger. Michael, how are you doing? Welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you, Alex. How about yourself?
I'm very well, thank you. All the better for speaking to you and having you on the show. So just to begin, before we get cracking, could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your sort of career journey, and how you came to be interested in what we're about to talk about?
Right. So pretty normal career background. I was an accountant first, became a tax attorney. So I have a CPA, JD, MBA, worked at a big law firm here in Atlanta, Georgia, doing international tax law. And then in March, as everyone else did, I saw one country after another implement these lockdowns, essentially a domino effect. It started with Italy, and then one after another, regardless of where these countries were in their infection curve, they implemented these lockdowns on China's model. At first, when, you know, Italy did it, I thought, oh, well, maybe I don't know as much about Italy as I thought. Maybe we're a little more authoritarian than I thought. So that's a little odd, but not sure. And then when I saw California lockdown here in the United States, I'm like, wait a minute. Now that's very strange. That has never happened in America, and that seems essentially antithetical to our values. It's I don't think that's going to work. I think that's going to be a disaster. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you have more states locked down, and not just that, but you had countries where lockdowns were just wholly inappropriate, where they were going to, you know, people were going to starve. You had India locked down. You had countries in Africa locked down. Countries with very young populations, where people live hand to mouth. And I just couldn't believe that. That's just unbelievable. Is the domino effect that powerful? And at that point, I still, like most other people, I thought that was just a big, colossal mistake. I thought that was just a, you know, colossal screw up. But when I saw these very poor countries start to implement these lockdowns, I got a little suspicious. So I looked back at just the timeline of what China had done, how they had done their lockdown in Wuhan, the communications they had with the World Health Organization, and started to think that maybe China had played a bigger role in pushing these countries to lock down than we thought. So this this hypothesis actually formed fairly early in April. And then I started doing more research, and you started getting these sort of weird propaganda, this manipulative propaganda that just seemed orchestrated, because it was essentially the same lines happening everywhere around the world. These sayings, seductive but nonsensical lines like 15 days to slow the spread, just stay home, just stay home. This very manipulative euphemism for let's suspend all your rights and, you know, universal house arrest. But, you know, just stay home.
Just stay home.
It's just very, things got very Orwellian very quickly, as I think most lockdown skeptics would agree. And that made me realize that there is something bigger behind this, that I, like, unlike I think most other people that just thought this was, you know, a giant cock-up, yeah, I started researching very early on how China might have been sort of driving this. It started out very hypothetical. I wrote sort of a rough draft about how they might be using the preeminence of health authorities, especially the World Health Organization, which is very much in China's pocket, as sort of a giant Milgram experiment of, you know, the doctor tells you to lock down, and you can do it once, and it doesn't seem to do anything. So he tells you you just need to lock down a little more. And it's just this kind of giant Milgram experiment they're doing with leaders. And they're still tongue true to that, but it was very sort of rough hypothesis at that point, because I hadn't actually gotten, you know, gathered the evidence, which has now become very strong, that China was coordinating a lot of this. And I did, very early on in I think it was early April, actually send letters to the CIA, the FBI, the Pentagon. I don't know if anybody actually read them, but...
I was going to ask you if they got back to you, but obviously not.
No, they did not. I don't know if that's affected the work. It does seem like the FBI is very on top of this story. Seems like the narrative is really kind of come around. They've made lots of big arrests of, you know, Chinese communist collaborators within America, which is very good to see. The whole lockdown narrative is starting to fall apart in America, but they have not ever gotten back to me on that at a personal level. So then sort of as things played out, I got in touch, I got on Twitter. I'd never been involved with Twitter before lockdowns. But Michael Burry, the genius investor, famous from The Big Short, I heard he was on
Twitter. Played by Christian Bale.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Great movie.
Yeah, it's a fantastic film.
Yeah, really great guy in real life, too. He was one of early sort of Cassandras, who said that lockdowns is going to turn out to be, you know, the biggest disaster of the century. And I read about him that he was doing this on Twitter, and that inspired me to get on Twitter.
It's really worth paying attention to him as well, because let's not forget, he was one of the very few people who saw the 2008 crash or 2007 crash coming.
Yeah, and, that's right.
You know, when it comes to records, it's a pretty good idea to not go with the Nostradamuses, but to go with the people who really think about what's going on.
That's absolutely right. So Michael Burry, that was kind of a giveaway to me that, you know, it's not just in my own head. This is, you know, there's something really wrong here. Once I got on Twitter, I started following Alex Berenson and Aaron Ginn, prominent lockdown skeptics, and got getting more involved in the lockdown community, anti-lockdown
and the
community.
And the previous guest on this podcast, I might add.
Yes, sir. Yeah. And I didn't realize, though, after a while, that the lockdown skeptics were not really digging into the China story that much. I'd sort of, you know, post a comment trying to orient people in that direction, but there was sort of a general agreement within the anti-lockdown community. This must just be a cock-up. We just have to clear up the facts. This will be over in a couple months. Everybody's going to realize how stupid they are and get back to normal. I had my suspicions about that. And so from the anti-lockdown community, I got more into the China Hawk community, which is a very interesting community with its own sort of group of characters. You have exiles, activists, professors who have essentially been sort of exiled from the academic community, religious dissidents from the Chinese Communist Party.
And just to explain, what is the China Hawk community?
It's just activists. There's protesters from Hong Kong. There's people who... anti-genocide activists due to what China is doing to the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. There's people who are ex-military folks who just know a lot about China's activities. Mm-hmm. And so I started posting my hypothesis there. Never really took off. The China Hawk community is not necessarily that against lockdowns, to my surprise. And part of that was because of the sophistication of China's psychological operation. They had this lab that I've concluded is essentially a decoy. And so that whole story about this could be a lab-made virus, that was essentially made to scare China Hawks and get them on board with lockdowns too. To tell them this was big, scary lockdowns, biological weapon, so that even people who hated the Chinese Communist Party and were China Hawks would get on board with the snake oil of lockdowns and agree to what was really China's goal in sort of introducing communism through these lockdowns.
Wow. So I need to jump in there, actually, because the the Wuhan lab, I just noticed going through your Twitter profile that one of your most recent retweets is from Tim Price, who was the first guest on Escape from Lockdown. And looking back to that episode, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, how the Communist Party can't keep anything locked up, and how, you know, it was either that or, you know, bats on toast in the Wuhan market. So why did you, or how did you come to the conclusion that the Wuhan the Wuhan virology lab is a decoy?
So that's actually something that I've concluded fairly recently. Some work that I've done with Jordan Schachtel. I think that's his how you pronounce the name. It could be total screw up, but anyway. So what we know is all lockdown skeptics know is that this virus is very, very weak. However, you have these sort of fake whistleblowers like this. This Dr. Yan, who has very sort of suspicious funding, funded through Miles Guo, who is a fake anti-China leader. It's all very sophisticated psychological stuff. So her funding is coming from the CCP through this fake anti-CCP leader. And her science is just, I mean, it's bunk. Jordan does a good job tearing it apart. So that sort of proves how the Chinese Communist Party, through its own sort of subversive means, has actually been promoting this biological weapon theory, this idea that the lab is scary and this virus is unique and scary and came from this lab, which is fascinating to think about, that Xi Jinping is so comfortable being hated that he is willing to have his own agents accuse himself of bioterrorism to further his ends of locking down the world. That's how confident he is that he'll suffer no consequences.
Well, they say better to be feared than loved, don't they?
Yeah, and he certainly lives by that. There's no question about that.
Well, actually, I've got the quote up here from Machiavelli. In his mind, it's better to be feared than to be loved.
Right.
The quote, exactly. It is better to be feared than loved if you cannot be both. Okay. That wasn't worth interrupting you for. I thought the quote would be more profound than that. Sorry. So please carry on.
Sure. So getting back to the sort of my journey here, I got invited from the anti-China community, thought that they might be able to convince them that these lockdowns were snake oil, that China was really trying to push these lockdowns, that the virus was just their sort of little decoy to do that. And that, you know, I didn't really recruit many people from the anti-China community to our cause, unfortunately, but I did start to learn a lot about what China had been doing from people who one way or another knew about it. And what China has essentially been doing, and it's actually pretty common knowledge, they've been buying, investing in universities, media companies, you know, funding journalists, think tanks, a lot of funding for professors, and especially scientists. And for a long time, nobody really knew what they were doing. Some people had, some very hawkish people had their own theories, but it's like, okay, I mean, if you want to invest in our universities and our think tanks, I mean, we'll take the money. I don't know what you're doing there. But, you know, with these lockdowns, it's become very clear, abundantly clear what the long-term plan was there. They're trying to monopolize the truth. They're trying to create an information environment where they can control what is the truth. And by doing that, you know, Xi Jinping is essentially be able to fake an entire pandemic. And that's really how they've done it, along with the social media environment, which they have really mastered the power of.
So let's do a deep dive here, because a lot of your original Twitter thread was based on this idea of these fake accounts. Now, we have this shorthand in the West where we accuse these fake accounts of being bots, i.e. controlled by an algorithm. And we're in a complete tailspin about this idea of Russian bots. And what was so interesting about what you said was, no. A, you know, Russia, I think its economy is the same size as Spain. You know, it's really not this geopolitical threat that people think it is. And, you know, in a way, we're kind of helping Putin on that side. But let's not even go into that. But if you're really looking for a hostile actor, then who's got the resources, who's got the economic power? It's the People's Republic of China. So tell us about why these bots aren't really bots in the common sense of the word.
That's correct. So China has for over 10 years had this army of social media propagandists. And they've done this for a long time. They did it just within China. And they sit there essentially all day. They're paid full-time employees and just churn out social media comments, just whatever the party line is. They And essentially, that's just to reinforce the party line and sort of make dissent and organized dissent impossible, because there's just hundreds of millions. They literally produce hundreds of millions of posts every year, just whatever the party wants you to say. So this is very long established in China. And within the last couple of years, and some people think it might have been inspired by Russia to some degree, seeing Russia's success with this little tactic, but China has taken that pre-established social media army, which is, you know, unparalleled by any regime, including Russia, and deployed it internationally. And I don't want to downplay Russian disinformation. I actually, one of the reasons I knew so much about disinformation going into this was because I was very appalled by Russian disinformation within America and elsewhere. Mm. And Russia kind of messes around with the right a bit. And so I was like, Russia is really, you know, messing with the Republicans. And I was kind of on top of that story for a few years. And I don't know if you know that scene from Jurassic Park where he's hunting the raptor, and the other velociraptor comes in from the left side, and, you know, he goes, clever girl. It's almost like that. And so China just kind of swoops in with this massive, I mean, drops the jackboot on the world. And that was a real attack there in terms of disinformation. Now, I knew that, you know, this propaganda must have been using social media to some extent, but I had no proof for the first couple months. So if you're familiar with my original thread, in June, I discovered this article by Paul Moser from the New York Times, where he identified this big social media disinformation campaign sponsored by the Chinese Communist Party. Mm-hmm. And it has thousands and thousands of accounts. And in the last couple of paragraphs of the article, he actually identifies one of the fake tweets. I went and looked at that fake tweet, and what I found was thousands and thousands of accounts, thousands and thousands of posts, literally promoting China's lockdowns in every language, in every dialect in the world. And this to me was, I mean, this was a smoking gun. That's what inspired me to start that original thread. You know, I had to share it with everybody.
And how do we know that these accounts are fake? What's the fingerprint, as it were?
It's really the linguistic tells. Unfortunately, with that article, the major legwork was done by the Israeli company, Nexidim. Mm-hmm. So they already flagged that activity as fake state-sponsored. So that led me to it. And when you look at those tweets, they all essentially say the same thing. So I took a sample. About a month later, I had the idea of sort of taking a pictorial sample so you can sort of go across and just look at them one after another. He said, you have one tweet here, it says, China is doing all this, and the U.S., we're just washing our hands. Another tweet says, you know, America, wash your hands, and then look what China is doing. Another guy says, this is what the U.K. should be doing, not just washing our hands. So they all just on the same script, thousands and thousands of tweets saying like, oh, we're just washing our hands while China is doing all these lockdowns. So essentially sort of advertising China lockdowns. And some of the tweets actually more explicitly say like, yeah, we should be locking down. Like, where's our lockdown?
It's funny because when you put out that mosaic of fake accounts, mm-hmm. and how they were all sort of primed for each individual region, each individual dialect. Obviously, as a British person, I went straight for the British ones. It was really interesting. Right. So there was one that I'd come across before, which was an account called Gunter Bett, who's sort of exclusively tweets from like a pro-Remain position, but very, very aggressively. And he was writing stuff early on about how the Britain is so stupid as opposed to the EU's wonderful response to COVID-19. And I thought, what? Considering, you know, the highest death rate in the world at that time, and until very recently, was Belgium, which is sort of right in the middle of the EU. You know, Spain had done very bad, Italy had done very badly, and the EU in general had not behaved in keeping with its original ethos, i.e. a lot of them had closed their borders, restricted their exports. And right. But as I came across this account, I thought I couldn't work it out. I thought, is this guy real or is he a parody? Because I can't quite make it. And then weeks later I saw him, you know, in the background in your thread, and I thought, bang, that explains it. That's why I couldn't work it out. And I've got one in front of me right now. Another one that you had from the UK. He's called at Dean Tweets underscore. And his profile reads, "My tweets are like your patter, pure caca, dog lover, R.I.P. ma'am, and then BLM." It's as if an alien has been sort of looking at a person in the north of England, or perhaps one of those sort of marketing profiles that you get of the typical consumer, and try to sort of replicate that, because he sort of incessantly tweets either about online gambling, or Domino's pizza, or
that's so funny.
Exactly, or now it's BLM stuff, and then, as you said initially, it was, "Oh, we're just washing our hands. Why don't we lock down?"
Right. So, yeah, and I think it's a mix. I think some of these are folks who are paid a certain amount of money to tweet this. You know, that's something China has always done within China as well. Sort of paid for tweets on an a la carte basis, so they might be somehow contracting these tweets out. And some of them, I'm sure, are tweeted straight from China through their firewall. But I do think the vast majority of them are generated by human beings who are, you know, one way or another, answering to Xi Jinping in China.
So here's the thing that makes it difficult to understand is the motive. Now, on the one hand, decimating the world through lockdowns, initially, it would seem that that would, you know, be a catalyst for China's overall foreign policy aim, which is the same aim of every great power, which is regional and ultimately global hegemony. But ultimately, China's economic strength is built on their export markets, and this will surely annihilate that. Or are we looking at something in along the lines of, is it that just China wants to be seen as some kind of world leader and just wants other states to fall into line behind them?
I mean, I think they want world domination. I think that's their sort of one goal. You know, people sometimes say, you know, China wouldn't crash the world economy because that's not in their interest. And contemporaries said this exact same thing about Adolf Hitler as well, that he would not try to start a world war because that would not be in his economic interest. So I do think Xi Jinping's interests are not totally economic. I think that being on top and domination are really the big motivations there. I do think the going back to some of the propaganda that we saw originally, the plans here were much deeper and darker than just causing an economic slump. When you go back to when lockdowns were really rolling, when China was really winning the information war, and there were just like just very tiny protests. Like, I think there was a protest with less than 100 people in North Carolina, and it was all over the news because who dare go out and protest these lockdowns? Who would dare have the courage to go out there when this big, scary virus is out there? Yeah. And a lot of the protesters ended up getting arrested because, like, how could anybody protest lockdowns? So there was a bit time there when the CCP was apparently really winning. And their propaganda was very bold. They were actually tweets saying, you know, "Oh, these protesters, you know, don't worry about losing your business because there will be plenty of work in the field soon, you know, like plowing the fields." And there's a few tweets that say that. So there was I think the plan here was deeper and darker than most people realize. I do think this was about sort of bringing the great leap forward to the rest of the world. Now, that is not to say that Xi Jinping really like believed that would ultimately play out. I think he's perfectly fine with just having this be like a giant slap to the rest of the world, sort of crashing the world economy in itself. It would be nice if he had taken over the whole world through these lockdowns, but but he's satisfied with just a massive economic collapse as well. you know, one way or another, I don't think he's going to be suffering any consequences here. That's one person you don't have to worry about in these lockdowns is Xi Jinping. He will be in control of China no matter what. So,
the sort of the global rich, as it were, certainly haven't lost out from these lockdowns. I think
that's correct. Yeah,
you know, Amazon has made huge amounts of money. It's really one way of describing it is it's a huge transfer of wealth from the poorest to the most wealthy, from the small businesses to the big ones.
That's right. That's right. I'm sure they're not. Yeah, they're not all evil. Needless to say, some of them I think are quite appalled by what's happened too. I've noticed that, you know, Twitter has taken absolutely no action on my tweets and my threads, despite the fact that they show that, you know, they played a nasty role in all these lockdowns. And that's because I think maybe Jack Dorsey is a little bit more pro-free speech than we think. So, you know, the internet can be a very dangerous tool for evil like lockdowns, but it can also be very important and bring about the end of those lockdowns through the information that we share.
I also think that, actually, because if Twitter really was this kind of, you know, liberal, totalitarian state, then none of us would be on it. And in actual fact...
That's exactly right. Yeah.
You know, well, like you said, you joined Twitter because of this. Some of the real greats at the moment, I'm talking about Alistair Haymes, I'm talking about Hector Drummond, all came to the fore through Twitter. Michael Yardley in the UK, he's a really interesting voice just now. Again, someone who's come up through Twitter, and a lot of us are
absolutely
communicating with each other and sharing things. And actually, it has been very positive in that respect. However, something I said to you just before we went on air, I would posit to you, anybody who listens really, that were it not for social media, and I'm not even sure I'd count TV 24-hour news in this, I might even just say just social media. So let's rewind the clock maybe, I don't know, to the late 90s. We would simply be talking about how bad the flu was this year. You know,
yep.
We would never have locked down. And do you think that is the case? Do you think it's social media that brought us here?
Absolutely. I mean, 100%. That is, you know, absolutely central to my entire hypothesis. I think that's something that it's very clear authoritarian regimes were far more aware of the power of that and the power of being able to direct those narratives than we were. I think they beat us in information warfare in this case. They've been generating propaganda that has been really the Chinese Communist Party's secret sauce. That is what they do ever since they were first founded in the 1920s. I mean, that's the only way they won the Chinese Civil War and took control of China is propaganda, because the truth was always awful. In every single place in China that they actually ruled, I mean, their people were just suffering. It was just, I mean, it was just absolutely terrible. So is this being able to control a narrative? I mean, they have a century of experience in that. Like, they're expert in that. So opening up this door into our country through social media, and sadly, not just America too, but countries that have absolutely no say in how social media is governed have been suffering through this. And this is a dirty secret that some social media executive has actually been deliberately hiding. There was an expose about Mark Zuckerberg, and a whistleblower from Facebook actually said that, you know, she had blood on her hands because of Zuckerberg had been deliberately downplaying this political disinformation, and not just major authoritarian powers like Russia and China, but even like little authoritarian countries like Saudi Arabia and Venezuela are getting in the game too, because it's that powerful being able to direct that messaging through social media. And Zuckerberg has really not been taking it seriously at all. He focuses on, you know, wiping out as many fake tweets as possible. Most of this just kind of corporate stuff. It's just kind of silly spam. The really devious stuff is the human-controlled stuff that's based on manipulating a political landscape. And so with China's experience in that, that was very central to this operation, was the social media aspect of it and this social media propaganda that I've really highlighted in my work.
So we talked about the strategy. Can we go into the tactics? Because that was something that really struck me about your thread, was the way you deconstructed the very specific tactics. Now, we just touched on it very briefly now about I think there was a very famous tweet that went viral where it looked like a tanker was going down the street, disinfecting the street, which is probably the most absurd disease control measure imaginable. Any epidemiologist watching it would go, "Oh, what?" And it was accompanied by tens of thousands of tweets just saying, "Oh, and all they're telling us to do is wash their hands," including my old friend Dean tweets here. but then what was really interesting was the way that you explained how all these, how can I put it? They act almost like a flock of birds, you know? They all do. kind of move in a single direction. So can you just take us through sort of almost play by play where their fire was targeted and you know, how the messaging moved on from one target to another?
Yes, sir. Yeah. And that's very interesting to look at how that strategy changed throughout the entire process. So originally, as soon as Wuhan locked down in late January, you had these videos coming out, these very clearly fake videos. And one of them is very funny that I've highlighted in my work, this video where this guy is supposedly suddenly collapsing in the street from coronavirus. Really scary virus. And he just throws out his hands. And it's just absolutely, it's just so silly because so clearly staged. And, you know, I hope they don't re-educate people in China for bad acting. Yes. But you know, you take this and the dozens of other videos that came out around the exact same time. And the only purpose of those, like, that was not propaganda to say, you know, how great China is, which is what people sometimes insist that the purpose of all the social media activity is just to, you know, say, go China. But the purpose of those fake videos, which went viral all over websites that are all banned in China, like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, these are all banned and blocked within China. And yet these videos supposedly leaked out of Wuhan and went viral all over Western social media of these people suddenly dying and collapsing and people getting caught with butterfly nets for breaking the lockdown rules, all these absurd videos of people disinfecting streets and everything and how scary
and,
this
is. I'd like to point out that Britain, as it stands, and most European countries and America have a much higher COVID death rate than China. And I have never, ever, ever seen once a video of somebody standing on Oxford Street falling down and dying in the middle of the street.
Right. So fortunately, I think a lot of people are starting to wonder about that. That has to be fake. And the purpose of making those fake videos was only one thing, to sow fear.
Yeah.
So as far back as January, they had these, you know, very deliberate operations to spread fear in Western countries. And that was before they even had any results from the lockdown. So that makes you wonder what their motives were. Now, we've gone through around March when countries started locking down. They had that massive Twitter campaign with we're just washing our hands, like we should be locking down like China. And then after that, you have some leaders who resist the lockdown narrative and don't lock down. And one of those famously is the governor of South Dakota, a very small state. But she has been very adamantly anti-lockdown. And so you have this state-sponsored activity that suddenly shows up on her feed where they're essentially just kind of bullying her and just launching this profanity after profanity at her for refusing to lock down, accusing her of murder, saying she has blood on her hands, saying that, you know, everybody's going to die and it's your fault. And I think in some ways, this is the propaganda army masquerading as her constituents to try to convince her. And also and at the same time, it simultaneously directs the narrative. Like, even if Kristi Noem does not see these tweets, her constituents might and think like, oh, maybe I should dislike Kristi Noem too. So it's propaganda at the same time that they're also masquerading to the public. So this is a very sophisticated way that they have manipulated the political landscape in country after country.
Right.
By contrast, with countries who support lockdowns, leaders who support lockdowns, like you have Daniel Andrews, who was really locked down Melbourne, Australia very strictly.
The man is the devil.
Yes, sir. Chairman Dan, yeah.
Dam Jong Dan.
Kim Jong Dan.
Yeah, Kim Jong Dan, that's the one.
And so when Dan locks down Melbourne and he posts this picture saying thank you, he shows these empty streets and he says, thank you for abiding by my lockdown and having no activity going on in Melbourne. And all these tweets show up saying the exact same language. Thank you, Dan. You are a great leader. Now go get some rest. And they all say, go get some rest, Dan. Go get some sleep. Thank you, Dan. Please have a good night's sleep. Hashtag I stand with Dan.
Oh, God. No.
So this whole, you know, social media army propping up, you know, Dictator Dan here, and getting behind his lockdown of Melbourne, which, you know, of course, most of the people posting on his thread probably do not actually live in Melbourne. They probably live somewhere in China, but but very insidious stuff.
It's terrible because Melbourne, I've said this before on the podcast, it really is, of all the cities, I've traveled a fair bit, and Melbourne is one of my favourite cities I've ever been to. It's fun, it's great, there's so much stuff going on, and to see it, you know, destroyed like this, you know, it's really heartbreaking. You know, I just feel it's awful, terrible. You know, just because somewhere that was so full of life and excitement, just, and the terrible thing is, there are a few voices in Australia who are sort of going against this, but not that many. It's been a bit sad, you know. We're not getting out. I mean, any Melbournean listeners, thank you. Keep up the good work. I love you. But with the exception, I must go against that. I have to say, the Sky News Australia has been fantastic on this, and they had Absolutely. You on, of course. And they're one of the sort of beacons in the dark for all of TV news globally. But having said that, you know, I have been a little bit surprised that there's not more coming out of Australia, especially Victoria, of people going, what's going on? We're stuck here. And it's very personal for me because my 2-year-old nephew is in Sydney, and my mother over here in England, obviously my dad too, they've not seen him in nearly a year, and they might not see him for another year. Now, I don't know if you have kids, but babies grow really effing quickly. And,
right.
You know, you if you don't see them for a month or two, you miss this beautiful stage of their life. And it's been taken away from my family, you know. And I find that incredibly sad that,
yeah.
You know, our family are not able to make the choice to see, you know, a beautiful young person in our family. But to sort of move off from that, let's talk about Boris. So,
yes, sir.
My partner is German, and prior to the British lockdown being imposed, my partner has friends and family all over Europe. And I think I made a note of it. So she had her friend in Italy, her friend in the Netherlands, her father who's in Romania, and her mother who is in Germany. All of them said to her, what's going on? Why hasn't Boris locked down? You know, so this is really right across Europe.
Oh, well.
And obviously, part of that is because, you know, because Boris was so prominent in favour of Brexit, he was very much a hate figure within the European media and the British media. But tell us about how our friends in Beijing turned their fire on Boris Johnson.
Right, right. And here's where you get into some of the sort of advanced psychological games that Beijing was playing. And the big theme throughout all of this is Westerners have just really, and I've talked to some of my followers and they agree that Westerners have just vastly, vastly underestimated the Chinese Communist Party. And part of that is, you know, because of our own racism, our own sense of, you know, superiority, that we don't think they're capable of this. Everybody thinks that, oh, they're not that smart. They couldn't be smart enough to pull all this off. Yes, they're plenty smart enough to pull this all this off. It's really not that complicated of a psychological operation. And they've been doing this propaganda for, 100 years, like I said. So what they start doing in early March is equating, and they do this through their own state media outlets. The editor-in-chief of Global Times, which is China's state-run newspaper, sets the tone by equating herd immunity, the strategy of herd immunity, with a violation of human rights. He goes, oh, Sweden and the UK are opting for herd immunity. What about human rights? Like, we would never have that disrespect for human rights in China. Like, you know, where is their concern for human rights with this herd immunity strategy? And you see that reflected in the tweets on March 12th and March 13th. All of a sudden, you get a storm of tweets accusing Boris Johnson of genocide and accusing him of, you know, murder and being a human rights abuser for not having this lockdown. This language basically never appears in Boris Johnson's feed ever before then. It's just all of a sudden, March 12th, March 13th, there's this massive wave of state-sponsored activity that's accusing him over and over again of genocide for not implementing this lockdown. And sadly, whether it was this or whether it was other modes of influence have, I mean, really changed Boris, because he was, at first, I mean, he was even more than Sweden, a very pro-herd immunity. And that has reversed entirely, tragically for the British people. He is now, you know, going for another lockdown.
Boris put out a video with the deputy chief medical officer explaining why masks don't work. Yeah.
Yep.
And now I'm sitting here, and masks are sort of compulsory in any indoor space, in any indoor public space in the UK. So the change has been terrific. I mean, I feel it's important to add that what I would say is this is a reason for the lockdown. This is not the reason for lockdown, because prior to the lockdown, we also had the infamous Imperial Report. Now, I'm not an epidemiologist, but my left testicle could write a better epidemiological report than what Imperial
did. That's right. Yeah.
But do you know what? To take an analogy from COVID itself, one theory that I subscribe to is that COVID is more dangerous in countries which have a lot of dry tinder. And by dry tinder, I mean lots of old people who are very ill, lots of people who have a lot of comorbidities, who have survived a couple of mild flu seasons, who may have been carried away previously, but are now, you know, prime targets for the lockdown. For COVID. And likewise, our social media has a lot of dry tinder as well, in terms of a lot of people who've got unsettled scores over Brexit, and obviously in your country over Trump, and who will use anything that comes along to beat them with. And a lot of, you know, suddenly along comes this army of social media abuse. You know, and so people will just grab hold of it, not realizing that, you know, this is profoundly more dangerous than Brexit or Trump.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And that's one of the things that makes it so effective. I mean, the ability to, the success they have had in directing the narrative has been absolutely profound. I mean, on, you know, on Twitter, I'm very connected with the anti-lockdown community. I have a nice following now. It is absolutely the opposite in real life. I mean, back when things were really touchy in April and May, you know, I was losing friends. I was, you know, debating people. I would put an anti-lockdown post on Facebook. I would maybe get like a couple likes, but people would just like, you know, post all kinds of comments, you know, accusing me of being like a, you know, a murderer and everything. I mean, these are, you know, friends I've known for many years. I mean, the success that China has had in directing the narrative, and all they really had to do was tip the domino to some extent. I mean, they create all this propaganda and people latch onto that themselves and they start, you know, driving the narrative themselves, real human beings. So that's what makes it so powerful. So it is definitely groupthink, but it is groupthink that was, I think, deliberately instigated.
So let's talk about the pivot. Because something you said in your tweet, which was also very striking, was that there was a pivot two or three months into lockdown where all these accounts which were incessantly tweeting about, you know, whatever, they'd mask it with their local thing. Obviously, our friend Dean tweets sort of rattles on about gambling and Domino's Pizza.
Right.
And occasional things about how we should lock down. And then suddenly it pivots towards Black Lives Matter. So tell us about how that happened.
Yep. Yeah, so as soon as you have the death of George Floyd, which is tragic, and then all of a sudden, all these accounts, which were just posting about nothing but COVID, they'll just start posting incessantly about racial justice, really radical tweets about racial justice and about, you know, justice for George Floyd, and not just in America, but in every single country. And it really just kind of makes you think, were those protests around the death of George Floyd, were those really organic? I mean, racial justice is certainly a big issue in America, and as well as other countries. But American police killing an unarmed black man, and then you have these global protests in the middle of a pandemic. Just, you almost have a brief pause from the COVID narrative where all of a sudden it's just the only thing that matters is the death of this one man. And you have these giant protests in city after city around the world around that, and including in Britain, which is just, I mean, to me, it just has nothing to do with the death of that poor man in the United States. I mean, why... It's very strange. It just kind of makes you wonder how much influence does China have controlling these narratives. We also know that they explicitly supported their Chinese state media outlets, explicitly supported those protests as well. That's one thing that they sometimes do, is they use their state media outlets to direct their propaganda troll army as to what to support and what not to.
Well, in Britain, I actually looked this up. We have something in the... We're around the third best country in the world for police murder.
Right.
So, to be fair to the protesters, America isn't doing ideally either. Actually, the levels of American civilians killed by police, it's actually a bit worse than the Congo. But having said that, I don't really want to give the protesters any credence at all, because fundamentally, I don't think anything has changed since Martin Luther King. I think his whole point was correct, regardless, you know, of the stuff about his personal life, whatever. I think it was a very positive message.
Yeah.
And also Nelson Mandela. Obviously, there's parts about when he was younger that people are a bit more sceptical of, and sort of the ANC's bombing campaigns or whatever. But having, you know, gone past that, you know, it was in a country which didn't have universal suffrage and was very, you know, definitely state terrorism being committed against the people, 100%. But also,
right,
when Mandela came out of prison, he said, no, like, the time for settling scores is now over. And he created the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was an enormously positive thing, because what it provided was a framework in which you could forgive And admittedly, it's not going completely brilliantly in South Africa at the moment, but I think that's more to do with kind of corruption and stuff. I don't want to be dragged into this whole thing as well. But the principle of forgiveness was applied in this country to Northern Ireland. And some of the people involved exhibited what I would call almost superhuman capacity to forgive. And it was very, very hard. Very hard. Because it meant absolute criminal murderers walking free.
Right.
But I think I do argue that that might have possibly been necessary, because Northern Ireland at the moment is actually a lovely place and they have come on in leaps and bounds. However, I feel that the thinking behind the Black Lives Matter movement is completely undoing all of that and completely going against that idea that forgiveness is important. I'm not even a Christian, but I think it's a very important thing, and I think, you know, it can work really well. And so, how much do you think this ties into... Do you think it's China's strategy to fundamentally just sow disorder within its opposing countries?
Now, I think sometimes it's about sowing disorder when that suits their purposes. But I don't think that was the case with lockdowns. Now, with Black Lives Matter, that's like racial justice. Like that's a real issue that people can care about. Like that's fine to protest that. But the fact that the entire narrative just temporarily shifted, the protests were temporarily okay, and scientists got on board with that too. Yeah, protests are okay. You can't open your business, but protests are okay just for a couple weeks, and then we go back to, oh, you can't do anything. I mean, that just shows how much influence China is having on this narrative that they had on it with COVID. And since they decided to support Black Lives Matter protesters, it might have been because I was right around the Tiananmen Square protest and they wanted to distract from what was going on in Hong Kong. One way or another, they decided to support those protests to create disorder. Yeah, as you said, within the United States around that time. And also to, I think, give cover to some of the more violent types of protests that we're seeing, like with Antifa. The Black Lives Matter sort of gave cover to that. Kind of a different form of communism, from a different aspect of communism, more violent aspect than what we see with the lockdowns. And of course, as soon as the protests were over, you go back to lockdowns.
So one of the things that came out of 9/11 was a very broad discussion about America's place in the world. And there were some very open and frank discussions about America's activities in the world. We're talking about, you know, involvement in coup d'etats, the involvement in backing up very unpleasant regimes, arms sales, you know, you name it. And at the time, you know, I was a teenager, and I wouldn't say radical, but I was definitely excised about the whole thing. And someone said to me, well, you know, I think America should be on top, because would you rather live in a world where Russia or China calls the shots?
Right.
And that did stop me in my tracks. And what I would like you to tell our listeners is what a world would look like where China called the shots. And could you begin by explaining what is going on within China? I'm talking about the human rights abuses. I'm talking about the Uyghurs. I'm talking about all the things that the CCP does.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And it's absolutely tragic what's going on in China. Xi Jinping is a brutal, absolutely ruthless dictator. He comes from the line of princelings. His father was one of the original revolutionaries who fought alongside Mao. And what he did is he resurrected Maoism within China. Religion has been strictly outlawed. Over a million officials
really?
Have been punished for... over a million officials have been punished, purged, for what Xi Jinping calls corruption, which is essentially just having your own thoughts. millions of Uyghurs and other minorities within Xinjiang province, East Turkestan, have been imprisoned in concentration camps and re-educated. Xi Jinping was very happy with how that panned out, so he's actually extended that now. He's actually introducing the same forced labor program within Tibet, which has been depressed for decades, but apparently not.
I mean,
not.
Can we just underline that? Concentration camps. Forced labor.
Camps, yes.
This is something
underline,
that should be on
bold,
every...
Italicized.
Yes. Sorry,
it's
please carry on.
It's completely unacceptable.
Yeah.
It's completely unacceptable, and I'll get to that. Yeah, so he's satisfied with Xinjiang. He actually moved that to Tibet. So now Tibet is falling under that jackboot as well. Hong Kongers, who we can identify with a little more because, you know, they're a little wealthier, a little more skilled. They can communicate with us. And they've done a great job bringing attention to all this. That, hey, look, he's Hitler. He's evil. So Hong Kongers have done a tremendous role in all this. Inner Mongolia is now trying to protest, trying to do what they can to bring attention to the tyranny. But, I mean, this guy is a ruthless, ruthless tyrant. And part of the reason that there has not been a global response to this, and this is part I wanted to get to, is that some readers sometimes think I'm being a little too hard on China, that maybe the problem is the globalists. Now, what is the globalists? The globalists is essentially the Chinese Communist Party. It is modern. Right. The Chinese Communist Party is not a party. It does not represent China. It's a secretive clique, and it always has been from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. It does. It represents a very, very small portion of China. But really, what it does is rule China under its jackboot, and that's always been the case. And now that party has gone international. They co-opt people. They bribe people. They blackmail people. However, whatever they can do to have influence. To have them under their spell. And that's what they do with elites across the world. And that's why we have these concentration camps, a growing system of concentration camps, but the world is somehow okay with that. The world is just saying, okay, yeah, that's bad, but...
I need my iPhone.
Right.
I need my DJI drone. I need that.
Absolutely. It's because of the influence China has on politicians, on universities, in think tanks, in news organizations, is because of how they control their image through censorship in Hollywood. That is the goal of controlling what is true and what is acceptable. That, yeah, you know about that concentration camps. We can't necessarily hide those, but it's okay. It's a Jedi mind trick. It's like, move along. Nothing to see here. Just keep going about as normal. You know it's wrong, but we're going to pretend, just go on normally as if it's okay. And it's the same thing with lockdowns. They have essentially taken that jackboot, and this is their jackboot on the entire world now, that all of a sudden, one day in March, the New York Times just announces that your rights are gone now. But that's okay. Just go along with it. And that's China's influence. The Chinese Communist Party, I should say, that's their influence.
So in your article for The Tablet, you explain this in terms of what's called Xi Jinping's personal philosophy of is it Kung Fang?
Feng Kong. Yeah.
Sorry, I got it backwards. Could you explain for listeners what that personal philosophy what's it? So Feng Kong, what Feng Kong is?
So Feng Kong is Xi Jinping's personal hybrid of health and security policy. And it's actually the exact same philosophy that inspired the concentration camps for Uyghurs in Xinjiang. And that is the exact same philosophy that inspired lockdowns. Lockdowns actually did not have any science behind them. The WHO very explicitly says this lockdown, Wuhan's lockdown, is new to science, completely unprecedented. So it is not something that, you know, we came up with. It doesn't have any science behind it. But Xi Jinping personally ordered it based on his philosophy of Hong Kong. So that is the origin of lockdowns. It's Xi Jinping's jackboot. It's the same as the concentration camps in Xinjiang. That's where lockdowns come from. It is not science. It is simply brutality.
If I could give you something that's close to my heart in terms of the spread of Fun Kung. So I'm English, but I went to university in Scotland. I had a wonderful 4 years there. And in normal times, yeah, I would advise everybody to do it. But University of Scotland released today, on the day that we're recording this, a series of guidance, or I might as well just say rules, for students going to university in Scotland. So 16 years ago, this would have been me. All universities will make absolutely clear to students that there must be no parties and no socialising outside their households. Communicating and reinforcing its messages on a regular basis using a full range of media channels. Breaches will not be tolerated. This is on the University of Scotland website. This isn't a piss take of it. This weekend, The first new tighter Scottish Government guidance will require students to avoid all socialising outside their households and outside their accommodation. We'll ask them not to go to bars. That's students can't go to pubs. I want to repeat that again. Students cannot go to pubs. We'll increase staff presence in the student accommodation to be vigilant against any breaches of guidance. We'll engage with further private providers of student accommodation, especially those who see them as a bed space, to follow our lead and strictly enforce guidance. We'll intensify our students' liaison with Police Scotland to ensure blah, blah, blah. We will take a strict yellow card, red card approach to breaches of student discipline that puts students and others at risk. We'll commit to further agile staff responses to immediately respond to cases. We'll require all students to download the Protect Scotland app. Now, Michael, does that sound to you like a healthy dose of Fun Kung?
It absolutely does, Alex. You're absolutely right. No, and I mean, it's just that, you know, absolutely insane level of authoritarianism that has been introduced within 2020. And that is exactly what the lockdowns are. It is this giant fear campaign to say, oh, you have the scary virus. Oh, maybe it came from our lab. You know, we officially deny it came from our lab, but we're going to have our own agents spread the idea that it came from our lab. And the only way to get rid of it is to just suspend these rights, do what we did in Wuhan. It worked so well. We eliminated the virus. It was so easy. So just do what we did. Just suspend all your rights. Suspend this one more liberty. Oh, you still have the virus? Take away free speech. Oh, still dealing with that virus? Take away your right to protest. Oh, now you can't go to pubs either. That'll get rid of that virus. Take away one thing after another until nothing's left. It's snake oil.
I mean, could you imagine being... you went to university, right? Of course you did. You're a lawyer.
Absolutely.
Could you imagine? So when I went to university, I was like, I had two aims. I had three in ascending order. One, where are the pubs? Two, where are the girls? And three, where's my lectures? You know?
Exactly.
And so could you imagine being a student today, sort of, coming in? And a lot of this tuition is now online anyway. So you basically, you have to just stay in your... I mean, it sounds like a prison, right?
It's absolutely, it sounds awful. I was, I read a story yesterday about a freshman, a first year student who talked to his professor and was in tears because it was so miserable. It just felt like prison. And to do that to an 18-year-old kid, it's just absolutely sad. Bad enough here in the rich world, but to do this into poor countries as well. I was talking to a gentleman from South Africa just before this call, and I mean, people are just starving in the shacks there. And I don't think we have any idea what the extent of that hunger and that misery is, because I think most people are still staying at home because of the lockdowns. And I think ultimately this is going to end up being something, an atrocity like the Great Leap Forward, where we don't know until many years later. Things move a little bit faster now. I don't think we're going to know until years later what the actual extent of this is. I think it's going to turn out to be one of the biggest atrocities in human history. So we can go ahead and slot Xi Jinping in right under Adolf Hitler as one of the most evil people in history.
I think so. And you always think you're never going to live through this. And, you know, all the time I find myself cycling home and I just sort of remind myself. I sort of play in my head like, oh, should I do this? And I thought, oh, no, I can't. You know, right. Should I go to the pub? You know, oh God, you know, that's going to be a whole bother. And I think, God, when am I going to wake up from this horrible nightmare? And the terrible thing is people tell you it's because of COVID, and they always say, no, it's because of the lockdown. And it's just yep. to go on to the student thing, I found this great little tidbit from a website called OutKick, which said 48,000 students, college students in America, have tested positive for COVID. Two of them have been hospitalized. So, as you would say, I ran the math.
Unbelievable.
And that equates to, what is it, 0.004%. I've been not dead, just hospitalized. You know,
yeah.
2 out of 48,000. So let me pivot a little bit back into China. So last year I did a small film for a British telly in Dominica, and it was a real sort of you know, dream job. Like flew out there, spent a few days there in this Caribbean island. Yeah, it was absolutely terrific. And when I was sort of driving around the island, and all the roads were really good, and this was interesting because Dominica was absolutely devastated by a major hurricane in 2017, and I was paying this local woman to drive me around, and she said, "Oh, you know, it's all China who's done this." And then we drove past this sort of a valley. And within the valley, just by the road, were these containers, these sort of converted for living. It was like a movie, because there are these kind of stenciled Chinese letters on the edge, and these sort of washing lines and the stuff. And it was basically sort of a Chinese workers' encampment, and they were there for. Dominica is a population of 70,000. You know, that's most towns of 70,000 you've not even heard of. I mean, I can barely think of a town of exactly 70,000 people. But I believe that is part of what's called the Belt and Road Initiative. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Belt and Road Initiative is Xi Jinping's personally named initiative. It is introduced into the Chinese Constitution. To essentially extend these loans, infrastructure loans, all over the world to make countries more dependent on China. And there is and actually some wealthy countries have started to sign on to this too. You have Italy was the first major country in Europe to sign on to the Belt and Road Initiative.
Oh, that's interesting.
Daniel Andrews in Victoria, Australia, signed on to the Belt and Road Initiative. He did not inform the Prime Minister.
Hello.
And he was rebuked for that. Alex?
No, I was just going, hello, in a sort of quasi-sarcastic way.
Sure.
please carry on.
Yeah, and so there is a strong connection between... Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand also signed on to the...
What? You're having a laugh. So hang on. So Italy, number one lockdown after China. That's a Belt and Road Initiative aficionado. Dan Jungung, as we've already discussed, the devil incarnate, has adopted. Was it you that wrote this? That his sort of main assistant was sort of like trained in China.
At a high level Chinese Communist Party academy, his longtime advisor.
Wow.
And
then Jacinda Ardern, who's decided to make New Zealand the new hermit kingdom.
Right. The first English speaking country to sign on to the Belt and Road Initiative. Very strong correlation between who signs on to this Belt and Road Initiative and who implements these lockdowns. And that could be, it is probably an indication that China is kind of making lockdowns a condition for these loans. And then also, there are some, it could be a sort of a natural correlation that these countries that sign on to the Belt and Road Initiative are more trusting of China. So they're also more inclined and more trusting of China's pandemic responses. So that's why they had lockdown as well. There's no question there's a correlation there.
And there's one country which has given us a lot over the years. It's given us ABBA. It's given us IKEA. It's given us Saabs. It's given us Volvos. It's given us meatballs. It's given, you know, blondes. It's given us Vikings. which all of that is a lot of fun. And the one thing it has given us is Anders Tegnell, and the one, and by implication, it's given us the light that we do not have to lock down to live our lives. And I think it was you that said as well that unusually there's quite a bit of beef between this country and China.
That's exactly right. That is an excellent introduction. Thank God for Sweden. That's exactly the role they have played in this. They are, you know, one of the only lights in a sea of darkness, an advanced country that did not lock down. So at least we have some data to go on to show that these COVID is not that dangerous and there's another way. And, you know, like most other people, I originally, when Sweden made that decision not to lock down, I thought that was just random. I thought it was just what they decided to do. But that turns out not to be the case. They actually have the worst relationship with China of any country in the Europe. And just before the lockdowns in January, there was an award that Swedish organization gave an award to a publisher who was currently imprisoned in China, a humanitarian award. And China was threatening them with things that were totally unrelated over this award, threatening all their trade ties, threatening just really massive consequences over this little award, this little humanitarian award. And Sweden was just fed up because they weren't going to play along. Like, they weren't going to back down. And they just felt like they weren't being respected as a sovereign country. And so I think that frustration they have with China is another reason they were so distrustful of China's lockdown policy. And China responded to that as well. They have launched this massive campaign all over their state media talking about how Sweden is a human rights abuser. We can't be friends with Sweden, telling all their people within China, don't go to Sweden anymore. They have no respect for human rights because they aren't doing a lockdown. Like, we can't be friends with a country like that.
So China, who brought us concentration camps of Uyghur Muslims, is accusing Sweden of human rights abuse.
Correct.
Easy, crazy.
It's all very Orwellian. It's very clever. It's too clever.
So you've been extremely generous of your time, and I'm so thankful that you came on the show.
Oh, thank you, Alex. My pleasure.
Oh no, I really hope that beyond Sky News Australia, more bigger channels will invite you to sort of be part of this, because I think, you know, what you have to say is a really important thing to bring to the argument, because fundamentally, I get a lot of messages from people tweeting me sort of, 5G, anti-vax, Bill Gates. And to be frank, I don't really believe in any of that. And, I even believe, I might even lose listeners for this, but I think Bill Gates, he's wrong. But I genuinely think his heart is in the right place. But what you've presented in terms of, a country, I wouldn't even say a country, like a force that has genuine malign influence, has the motive, the means, and the method to, manipulate the world, it's the Communist Party of China. And to anybody who might say, oh, no, that can't possibly be true, I just have two words: concentration camps. I'll just say again, concentration camps,
a growing number of them,
More, oh my god. Okay, so before I let you go, what I'd like to ask you is, how has this changed your life and the way that you look at the world?
It's really changed it a great deal. Like most other people, if you had asked me last year, I probably would have told you that China, definitely an authoritarian country, but they usually play by the rules. They're okay. That has changed dramatically. This has been my wake up. And I've talked to dissidents in that little niche anti-China community who have been aware of this for many years, one way or another. Some of them were religious dissidents within China. Some of them are military intelligence folks who knew about what China was doing, sort of wrapping itself around our elites, our universities, warping the truth in their favor. And that's just really blown my mind, because like most other people, I had no idea that was happening. And that is deliberate. It's totalitarianism. It has always been totalitarianism, and they are trying to bring that to the rest of the world, because that's what totalitarian regimes do.
And what about your personal life? You mentioned you lost friends. Does this, you know, I don't know, like, does this change the way you feel about, say, protecting your family? Does this change the way you look at your friends and the discussions you have?
Yeah, I was definitely, I was disappointed at first with that I was so alone and being against lockdowns amongst my liberal friends, because, you know, I thought, my friends are quite liberal, I am as well. I thought we really believed in this stuff, that inequality really mattered, that we were really trying to help the poor. To see everybody just kind of throw the poor under the bus like this, that was really sad to me. That was too bad. And that does make you see things a little bit differently. Like, who are these folks I've been hanging out with? We're still friends. You can't let politics get in the way of friendship, and I still hang out with them. But I think it made me feel good that I felt like I sort of passed that test, and very few people I know that I know did.
Wow.
But
that's real food for thought, Michael. And, you know, I think one of the things that we're finding with this whole, you know, awareness of politics that a lot of the young have these days is, you know, people very much want to fight a battle. And I think Douglas Murray referred to a real supply and demand problem with the anti-fascists, and, you know, there aren't as many fascists around in the West. But actually, there's a very real fascist, and it's very dangerous, and it's very cruel, and it kills a lot of people. And I'm really, really thankful that you are shining a light on this, and I'm very pleased that people are taking what you have to say seriously. And another thing that's worth mentioning as well is that, like, so James Dellingpole, who's a friend of mine and a great podcaster and a real sort of fire-breathing lockdown skeptic, talks about the civilians, because it's very easy for the people of established, you know, who've got established platforms, who are skeptical, who can come and say to all their followers and people who know them, you know, this is bad. But, you know, there's people like you, there's people like Alistair Hames, Hector Drummond, Mike Yardley, who are saying, who really, you know, weren't really known before this, who were standing up and being counted. And I think that's a really wonderful thing.
Thank you. No, I really appreciate that, Alex. Yeah, I mean, tyranny is one of those things that has just always been a part of human history. Tyrants come in every century, and people have to come together against them. There were tyrants in the 20th century, in the 19th century, in the 18th century, in ancient Rome. And if we can't come together across political divisions to face Xi Jinping, I mean, we might as well just fold up the flag of the United States and the flag of the British Empire and just give up now, because that's exactly what he wants.
Wow. And do you know what? For the Chinese Communist Party, which I understand was ostensibly built on protecting the working classes, what you said about throwing the poor under the bus really resonates, especially because today I was listening to Planet Normal, which is a podcast by the Telegraph newspaper by Liam Halligan, another former guest on the show, and Alison Pearson. And they interviewed Sunetra Gupta, who is one of the great epidemiologists, I think, around in the world today. And she has been so brave and has so much crap thrown at her for standing up and saying, no, I am a woman of science and I believe this is wrong. And her words in the interview, which it was weird, it was quite moving. Like, I found myself quite moved as I was walking from the tube today. she said, just like you, this is throwing the poor under the bus. You know?
Yeah.
It's horrendous. So, Michael, if anybody wants to read more of your work, read your articles, get in contact, read what you're saying, what's the best way? What's the best thing to do?
Yeah, please do. Please reach out to me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Michael P. Singer. Or if you're not on Twitter, you can just look up my article. It's called China's Global Lockdown Propaganda Campaign. It's on Tablet Magazine. You can also check out my interview with Sky News on YouTube. Check them out. Just look up my name, Michael Singer, and Sky News Australia, and it should come up.
Well, Michael, I really hope that's just the beginning of your media career, because I think you've got a lot to say. And I've said
before,
but I'm just so grateful that you came on the podcast and we're able to have this chat, because it's been absolutely fantastic.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Well, dear listener, thank you so much for tuning into the show again. It's strange because when I began this show, I was initially reluctant to do the show because I thought the lockdown would only last 3 weeks. And yet here we are, and I keep talking about repurposing this podcast into doing something else, and yet I can't because the lockdown keeps dragging me back. Exactly. It does. So the short on that is that I'm going to be continuing this for the foreseeable future, because this damn thing is going to be going on for the foreseeable future. But rest assured, I have lots of great guests coming. I think you'll agree that we had a brilliant guest today. Thank you, Michael, again. And
thank you, Alex.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael. And yeah, just I've got some great ones lined up. Still, I know I say this every single week, but I do still have more people brilliantly lined up. And until next time, don't let this shit get you down. Take care. See you next time. Escape from lockdown. Goodbye.